Welcome to the next edition of our speaker series here from the Patika Wealth Management Group in Clearwater. This is John Patika Jr., joined by our senior member of our team, John Patika Sr. And there's a lot going on in the world today, so I'm really excited to have our special guest with us to help sort this out. We have our special guest is Admiral Jonathan Greener, who is a native of Butler, Pennsylvania, which is near and dear to our hearts because most of our family is from Pittsburgh. General Greer graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1975 and completed studies in nuclear power for service as a submarine officer. His bio is full, but he commanded and has assignments as a commander of the Submarine Squadron 11. He commanded the U.S. forces in the Marianas, commanded the 7th Fleet, and then in September of 2011, Admiral Greer became the 30th Chief of Naval Operations. Welcome, Admiral. We're happy to have you on.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be affiliated with UBS, and it's also a pleasure to be with you all today. I think it's really cool that we have a father-son combination here doing a podcast. I'd love to do such a thing with my son if I could.
Thanks. Admiral, this is John Sr. We usually try to do this in 30 or 40 minutes, and there's a lot to cover, of course. So what I'm going to do is just to ask you a simple question to get us started. It seems every day another geopolitical event pops into the news. If you take us around the world and summarize some of these threats to our stability, we'll go deeper in a little bit here about each one of those. And if you would, please use your insights and include issues that might be below the media's attention threshold, I should say, but they should deserve our attention. So if you would just take us around the world for a couple of minutes, would appreciate it.
Thank you. So I think, first of all, I'll speak to what I think about as geopolitical risk. In other words, what is the risk to geopolitical stability and therefore economic stability? Because that's what is most important, short of an all-out global war, which is really that threat is low. Everything is relative. If you say, well, my gosh, this is insane. Every day there's something terrible happening. Say, well, okay, but historically, the violence in the world is still low, number one. Number two, let's compare where we were a year ago and we'll look around. So let's go to the number one threat we say the U.S., and it is the number one global possible threat, and that's instability in the Western Pacific, China. I think we're kind of in a strategic pause for a number of reasons. Compared to a year ago. Number one, think about it. We have a summit with the two leaders of the two greatest nations here in April, followed by another visit later in the year. That's good. We have tentative agreements we didn't have a year ago in critical minerals and chips and semiconductors. That's good. Look at Xi, who visited the Republic of Korea. That would have been unthinkable a year ago, meeting with the president and having a discussion on a whole host of things, including what do we do about North Korea? Lowest birth rate in history just recently, and they got economic problems internally. So what I'm saying is them going toward a Taiwan confrontation to annex Taiwan, that risk is kind of low right now by all indicators, including intelligence and otherwise. Go to Europe. The big issue there is Ukraine, Russia, and we're in a quagmire. Probably through the winter. A year ago, we were looking at, hey, Russia is starting to really gather momentum and they're getting ready for a big sprint, maybe winter, spring campaign. Not so much. And we were threatening to not share intelligence. But now the Ukrainians are getting intelligence. The EU has now started to engage and provide pretty much all of the fiscal help. And that's what the Ukrainians really need now. We can talk about this in more detail later. They need fiscal help more than just artillery and weaponry, et cetera. Peace talks have been stalled, I agree, but they are ongoing. And there are plans being discussed back and forth that are underway. Ukraine is suffering, no question. Russia is going after infrastructure, critical infrastructure, including energy. But they're stout and they're committed. Move to the Mideast, and I'd say maybe in the last year, the biggest change. A year ago, it was terrible what was going on in Gaza. And now we at least still have a peace accord, or let's call it a ceasefire, headed toward a peace accord in progress. one phase is done. Some say, well, begun, half done. I don't know about that, but at least it's holding. Iran is nothing compared to what it was, say, a year ago, when even it was faltering then. And they're in trouble, and we're all very familiar with that situation. They're just not a threat right now. And Arab nations in general are really engaging in where are we going to go with Gaza and what are we going to do about Iran? And that's important. They haven't just gone internal and let things go with conflict between Israel and Iran. Lastly, let's go to the Western Hemisphere. Nothing was going on in the Western Hemisphere a year ago. From the perspective of the United States looking south, which has festered for so long, for decades. Number one, in the problem with immigration, I think many people would say, hey, the president came in and they've done a pretty good job with immigration. But this whole idea with ICE and what's going on in the various cities, the policy seems to be wobbly in that regard. Drugs are being addressed. We've talked about this, we in the collective, what are we going to do about drug trade, fentanyl, et cetera, and it is at least being addressed. Federal government, well, lo and behold, they are actually putting together the 2026 budget, maybe better late than never, but they're putting those together, and there's great optimism that we'll have a federal budget by the end of a month instead of a potential shutdown, instead of another continued resolution. We still have judicial and legislative challenges by the executive branch. And those are rabbit holes I'll avoid right now, but it's still going on. The Western Hemisphere is not languishing. The president has addressed Venezuela, good, bad, or different. It's been addressed. Cuba's been on notice. Colombia is on notice. These have been problem areas that have festered for a long time. And soon we'll have a decision on who is in control of the ports on either side of the Panama Canal. And is that acceptable? And we needed to get that because that was exposed as a problem, i.e. China had too much control, we felt. So a run around the world in summary, I'd say it's a little bit of a strategic pause. There's a lot of balls in the air. And the old saying is we got to figure out which one are crystal and make sure those aren't the ones that drop.
I like that, Jonathan.
Let's start with Greenland. Why do we need it? How will it help us if we're able to secure it?
Yeah, that's a very good point. There's a lot of geography. People are going back and getting a geography lesson. I think if one goes and looks at the world from the North Pole, like you're 50,000 feet above the North Pole, and you look at where Greenland is, you say, hey, whoa, anything coming over the pole toward Canada and the United States kind of goes over Greenland. And that's why we still have a base in Greenland with a high aperture that is very, very good resolution radars to detect any kind of hypersonic missiles or ballistic missiles or cruise missiles coming over the poles from Russia, potential adversary. If you look at Greenland, you say, okay, I see that it's an island. Again, I'm talking about looking at it globally, not on a standard Mercator chart where it looks like it's over half the size of the United States. Not that big, but it's about a quarter of the size of the United States. But if you look at it from the top, you say, well, it's just a bunch of frozen wasteland. But wait, that ice is melting, and it has been. So there is now a maritime path, if you will, to get from the Pacific across the northern, the high north, as we say, into the Atlantic. And so it's becoming a pretty big economic factor. But in a nutshell, Greenland is, geography is forever. Geography is always strategic. Greenland's very important to NATO. Greenland's very important to us. That's the issue. With the things that I said, I can understand the country, the president saying, we have to have Greenland. I understand the need for the importance, one. Two, I didn't even mention minerals. There's a lot of critical minerals in the ground in Greenland, but they're hard to get at. And then number three, with Russia going in the direction they are with hypersonics, upgrading their nuclear program, we have to be sure that we are in the right position to deal with that. Not to mention the underwater factor. Greenland is part of an acronym that was very popular in the Cold War called the GIUK gap. And that's the maritime, it is the ocean gap between Greenland, Iceland, and the United Kingdom. I think of that as a maritime highway on the surface, of course, but particularly underwater. Soviet submarines in the day, Russian submarines now, U.S. submarines, French submarines, U.K. submarines, it goes on. That's the track right there that and underwater cable. With a whole bunch of factoids here and there, I throw out to you, it's really important. How it's developed is clearly the question of the day. The most recent kind of a statement coming out of the president just before we got together here is that, well, we won't use force to resolve the Greenland issue. Well, that's important because that would be illegal by a whole host of reasons. And we could talk about that if you want. But let me stop there and say, hopefully, that gives you an idea of why is Greenland important. It's geography, it's economics, that is the critical minerals, and it's strategically important for our security and NATO security.
Totally random question, Admiral. When you were commanding submarines, did you ever go under the ice up in the Arctic and go around that way?
Yes, we did. And it goes on, if you will, all the time. So the opening of the ocean, you know, the melting of the ice above Greenland, and the fact that that's not land under there, the Arctic is in fact an ocean. Again, that's a big deal. What's going to become of that? People say, well, we should militarize the Arctic and we won't do that. Two military officers, and then the Russians, they're military officers, what for? And there are bases up there. So it's a matter of staking your claim, if you will, and putting yourself in position to be secure.
Interesting. Just a little bit on Venezuela as we move on. You know, it looks like a regional issue, but will this become a global issue? They've got allies everywhere, you know, the Korea, Russia, China, Iran. What do you think?
I think it will remain a regional issue. I say that because when the Maduro operation was done, for lack of a better term, one would have thought if Iran, if Russia, or if China really were concerned or had it, how important was it when the only thing I recall coming out of that was, Russia saying, well, you shouldn't have done that. And that was about it. China's done pretty much nothing. Iran can't do anything. By the way, this isn't the first time action, you know, we take action and this axis, which we discuss a lot, the axis of China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, there's no reaction. I go back to the bombing missions by both Israel and us on Iran. That didn't result in anything. No tangible action. So I think it will be regional. I say this because let's presume it continues on being a matter of economy, economics, oil, if you will, access to things. That's one thing. But if it becomes somewhere along the line where there's occupation, that's a whole other matter.
The most important, I think, to the financial markets where we live is Taiwan. I see where a few months ago, China conducted a large-scale military exercise, they called it, near Taiwan. Is it a rehearsal for a blockade or an invasion? How near are they getting to going after Taiwan? And then also, in the same vein, the Chinese had military drills with Russia and Iran in South Africa. Is that a precursor to something? Well, you know, those guys seem to get together. You talked about it a minute ago where they don't seem to react. What's your thoughts on Taiwan?
I'd break them down into two parts. First of all, the operation done by China in and around Taiwan was, in fact, a rehearsal. They have been doing these rehearsals for about 5 years, probably 6 years. And we collectively didn't really call them rehearsals for operations because we thought, well, that's kind of agitating. And then the collective wisdom led by the commander of the Indo-Pacific in Hawaii, Admiral Paparo, said, look, we got to call a spade a spade. Look at what they're doing. Look at the size and the scope of it. This is a blockade exercise, or this is a precursor to an invasion. We can't be fooling ourselves or kidding ourselves or trying to convince ourselves that isn't what they're doing, one. Two, they've been very clear that they want to annex it, and they're going to do it at some point. So having said that, though, John, it doesn't necessarily mean that it is imminent. And I say it because it's a matter of risk. There's the Chinese philosophy of how to accomplish not only a military operation, a security operation, and annex territory. And throughout the ages, and in their theory and their philosophy today, do it with as few casualties as possible to the Chinese. And so you want to demonstrate and show your potential enemy, your adversary, that it is futile to resist, that you just might as well kind of roll over and see the inevitable. And so China is on that track. If they could do that, they'll do it economically, they'll do it socially, they'll do it with what we call gray zone operations. Think of cyber, think of media, think of energy pressure, to say it's hopeless. So think of it as like a suffocation, if you will. So to answer your question, China is continuing to hone their capabilities. Xi Jinping was very clear, by 2027, I want you all, the military, to be capable to do it and to be ready to do it. That would be annex, if forced by necessary, Taiwan, by 2027. So that's the track they're on. But wait, the more they look at what's going on in Ukraine, that was supposed to be simple. That was supposed to be open pretty quickly. That was not supposed to be so complicated, from logistics to medicine to all the things that have complicated that quagmire. He can't afford, Xi Jinping can't afford that in a Taiwan operation. It's got to be successful. It's got to be quick. The Chinese people expect that. That's what he's promised. And if they get themselves bogged down in an operation, terribly costly, economically and otherwise, that will be kind of a disaster for him. And all the gains that he has made as the premier for all of these years could be lost on what is really the last golden ring there he's reaching for, the annexation of Taiwan. So it's a matter of, so what are we doing about it? We want to think of it like SOW, so risk into this. Like, not today, this isn't a good time. It's a high-risk element. So continue to perceive it as a high-risk element. His internal problems that I kind of alluded to before are saying, like, this is not the time. So I think we're looking beyond 2027, unless we, the U.S. or Taiwan, does something to trigger China to feel like they have to act now.
Just curious, how would Taiwan defend themselves? Are they capable of defending themselves?
Yeah, good question. First, if there's a blockade, they would defend themselves by being smart enough to, we've promised them that we will help them. Now, I don't know to what degree that is. If you talk militarily, it'll take a long time to get a force of any magnitude over there, I think weeks, okay? Because you're talking about aircraft carriers coming from the West Coast. Well, that's at least a two-week travel over there. Then you got to get organized and go in there. And that's presuming this happens fairly quickly. And that's also presuming that we very quickly have a meeting at the White House, the Pentagon, and Congress and say, all right, fellows, we're going in. It takes a while. So what does Taiwan do? The question to Taiwan is, how well are you postured to deal with what might be a blockade? How much water do you have? How much energy do you have? How much food do you have? They don't have a lot of raw materials. They are not a predominantly agricultural nation. It's a fairly, their topography, very mountainous. Point is, they import the vast majority of their resources. They're very high tech. They're very good, obviously, chips, premier, world premier, and chips, and a whole host of other high-tech elements, but they need raw materials. So how long can they hold up, number one? Number two, if it's for months, then it's very difficult to run a blockade that long. So now it becomes, how do we get the energy in there, and how do we defeat this blockade? And that's a whole kind of longer topic. It can be done. If they try to invade, that is the Chinese, I got to tell you, in my time studying various things, especially as a Navy officer, an amphibious assault, taking ships with people across and going ashore against an enemy that doesn't want you there with a tough topography, a lot of rocky beaches, a lot of cliffs. You're in a tough situation. You got to have probably an 8-to-1 advantage to get this done properly. Then once you land, it's not mission accomplished, as we learned in Iraq. If you're an occupier, you're in a disadvantage. So if the Taiwanese people say, I don't want you here, and I am all in, and I am all in together, they can resist very well. See Ukraine and see how complicated that mission was.
It makes sense that they would do a blockade to see how that, how do you break a blockade? You said there, you know, you have to do it in 60 seconds, John, but how do you break a blockade?
Well, first you use airlift. So you do airdrop. You say, oh boy, that's a lot of airplanes or drones, because there's a lot of logistics drones out there today, one, but mostly shipping. To have a full, you can't put a ring of steel around the island of Taiwan. So you got to find the ports where you can get a corridor of a operation ships, U.S., Japan, Korea, who say they'll be in, and you escort them in and out. China resists. Now China has taken on a fairly big coalition. So that's the important part. Now, the challenge, to summarize it, is a lot of Taiwan's energy ports are on the West Coast. That's tough because that's facing China. A lot of the food ports where they import food are in the Southeast area. That's difficult too. So it's not easy, but it's also hard to hold a blockade. The U.S. operation to blockade tankers, you know, down in Venezuela. Well, first of all, it's loosely successful. And then number two, that's much easier. You got big tankers versus the potential for several cargo ships, container ships trying to get in.
Wow. I could talk about that all day, but we need, due to time, to move on a little bit. You mentioned Ukraine. You know, that war keeps grinding on. Well, I want you to comment, if you would, about what 2026 looks like. Also, what are we learning there? It's such a devastating thing to the lives of the soldiers with these drones and anti-drone warfare. What can you say about that? What is the United States learning about going forward?
Good question. Let's say, perhaps look at it this way. February, March, April of 2022, this thing kicks off. It was all about it being the keys to success: intelligence, logistics, artillery, tanks, being able to move troops quickly, so aircraft, offload on there, and transportation, getting control of transportation. And all those things, Russia failed. So they never got to Kyiv, and they failed at the airport at Kyiv, et cetera. So then it became, we need 155 millimeter, because that's the predominant artillery shell. We need millions of those. And it started looking like, wow, look at this. A lot of trenches, a lot of mines, a lot of barbed wires, looking like World War One with modern weapons. And we started getting into missiles, et cetera. Today, you mentioned this, it's about drones and missiles and intelligence and logistics. You can't move today without being seen. If it's other than a gaggle of people, 5, 10, 20 people, you can't move whole battalions, 500 people are there, or you're going to get seen, you're going to get targeted, and you're going to get attacked. The ability of Ukraine to manufacture drones in 2022 and 2023 early was in a few thousands, maybe 10,000. Today, they make on the order of tens of millions, I mean that, that's what I read, of drones. Now, they're not all large attack drones. Many of them are very small. They're used for very tactically, you know, the kind of things with the four rotors that we see. Some of them are them. Some of them are logistics. Some of them deliver weapons, obviously. Some of them deliver a whole host of things of different nature, intelligence, et cetera. The ability to share intelligence is dramatic. There are companies like Palantir and other U.S. companies that are very good at assimilating big data and getting rid of the noise, getting the signal down. And so whoever has the information fastest probably wins or gets the first shot off. And the Ukrainians are using Palantir and other companies in a huge way, and they're very successful at it. Now, Russia has suffered dearly because of all of what I said, these Ukrainian advances, but they are learning and turning as well. So it's a matter of which of these two can stay ahead in that regard of the, what do you know, that gets to intelligence and AI, because you assimilate that data quickly, use drones and quickly respond to that. Recently, Ukraine has said their kind of brand has been, we are going to make the Donetsk and Eastern Ukraine unconquerable, as opposed to saying we're going to win. And what they're going to say is we're not going to lose. This area will be unconquerable. Well, how do you do that? AI, drones, and the ability to see everything and then respond to it, including the biggest problem in, say, the last 8 months has been who owns the sky. And we see that, and we read about it a lot when we read about all these Russian attacks on the energy infrastructure. And so what Ukraine is working very hard to put in place, and they're having some success, increasingly some success, is to have a surveillance system that sees the early stages of a Russian attack using artificial intelligence and all this data of all previous attacks, saying, based on data, this is where they're going, this is the track they'll make, and then get the drones up in the air to defend and knock down the attack before it gets deep into Ukrainian territory. So this is a very modern, cutting-edge battlefield. I would hesitate to say, and people tell me, well, hold on here, this isn't necessarily the way you'd fight something in the Taiwan Straits or in the Western Pacific, because the geography is different, number one, and the distances are full-scale greater, quantum leap greater. This is a defined battle space that has been for a long time. But I'll summarize by saying, you know, what Ukraine really needs now is statistics, information, and money. They have an astounding defense industrial base now, and there are astounding number of Western companies invested in Ukraine on the ground and building factories. Ukraine builds their own cruise missiles now. It's called the Pink Flamingo. Yeah, they're painted pink and a whole host of other things.
Wow, that's awesome. What if, you know, I see Trump wanted a 50% increase in the defense budget. Whether that's doable and sustainable, I don't know. But what would he do with all that? What's your thoughts on that? We probably have another 3 or 4 minutes left.
Okay. Well, a lot of it is, a great deal of it is to put into the maritime infrastructure. Think shipyards, dry docks, labor, huge numbers of labor. Well, how much? Today, we probably have 200,000. If you include all maritime workers that work on Navy ships, commercial ships, design engineers, etc. Secretary of the Navy says we need 250,000 over the next 10 years. Well, you can't just go out and hire people. They're not out there sitting around saying, hey, I've been waiting to hear from you. You've got to convince them that's a good vocation, and then you've got to train them and pay them, and you've got to think there has to be enough work to sustain that. So this is to put a real shot of adrenaline into the maritime defense industrial base, number one. Number two, I mentioned missiles, hypersonics, and all that. We're pretty good at developing them, innovating them. In fact, we're really good. We don't build nearly enough, and we're finding this just looking at the Ukraine conflict. So we need a shot in the arm to build munitions and sensors. So that's a big part of it. And we have to show the defense industrial base, your Northrop Grumman, your Lockheed Martin, your General Dynamics, your Raytheon, that we're serious about it, that is the government, and we will give you a multi-year contract. So putting a huge down payment on that is a big deal up front. And that's what a lot of this is for. You may have seen out there, he wants a battleship called the Defiant, the first one. Okay. The amount of engineers and R&D, research and development, he's doing that is astounding. So all of that is sort of a down payment. Now, can you say that? Well, I don't know. First of all, you got to get it up on the hill and see if you can get it, that budget through Congress. Number two, the next Congress. Number three, the next one. And then, if you're lucky, over it to the next administration. Congress is a different branch of government altogether. They have a long history of not being willing to commit to fund things year over year over year. In other words, commit this year that they will approve a request over the next 3 or 4 years for something. That's committing the next Congress to something, and obviously taxpayers. So we could go down the rabbit hole of what this will do to the national debt and what our situation is with there. Trump says, well, I'll pay with this with tariffs. Well, the best summary I saw said, well, how about maybe half of that if all the optimistic outcomes of tariffs comes to boot? In other words, $200-300 billion from tariffs. Well, that's not happening. You see my point. I mean, he put money where his mouth was, to his credit, number one. Number two, he's telling the defense industry, I want you guys to get going. And so here's my money. Where are you? So it has to be done. But boy, John, I don't know how sustainable it is. Finally, we are wearing out our military. It's not really spoken much, but we're doing all of these Aegis operations, from bombing Iran to, you know, the big armada down in the Caribbean, keeping China at bay over there with deterrence, to modernizing a whole host of our nuclear triad. So there's a lot going on, a lot of people deployed, a lot of maintenance. And we have to have a serious conversation. How big a military do we need, and are we willing to sustain it? Because we've got to pay for it, or we'll just wear it out.
You know, another random question, John. You ever have to testify in front of a congressional committee?
Oh, yeah, sure. In my last two jobs, I had to testify at least 8 times a year because your job is, my last job, I was chief of the Navy. My job was to go up and testify, answer questions to the Navy's request for the budget 2 years hence. So the chief of the Navy is going up this year in 2026 to talk about the budget that would go into effect in 2027 and then consequently in 2028. So he'll go before four committees for the House and four committees for the Senate.
I don't envy you for that.
It's not really a fun thing.
Admiral, as we begin to start closing this call out, just want to thank you for spending some time with us today. I mean, we covered a lot of topics, and it's great to hear from someone with so much experience like you do. And last question is, do you have any just final thoughts of something that our listeners should know that we might not have covered during this call?
Yeah, I think if one would say, what are the other risks out there, maybe even threats? It's really energy. We're all familiar with AI. Boy, we're headed on. That genie's out of the bottle. AI is data. Data is data centers, you know, routers, et cetera. They need energy, a lot of energy. We barely have the means to produce and deliver energy today for what we have. And I think everybody has heard these amazing numbers of how much more energy we'll need. I'm talking electricity. It's on the 20, 30, 40%. And the means for that is unknown now. We have put our chips, we, this administration, on fossil fuel. We just have. And we're not real big on going with renewables or stored energy batteries, including vehicles. We're just not big into that. In fact, we kind of hold the market back from that. And China's taking off in that direction. There'll be a reconciling of this, whether we're doing the right thing or not, at some point in the future. And it will be who controls really the main aspects of energy and energy for AI. And that's a pretty important thing that's going to reconcile itself in the next number of years.
Well, Admiral, once again, we want to thank you for your time with us. We really appreciate it. And that was a very informative conversation.
Yeah, great job. Thank you. I'd like to get you back just to talk some oddball things about weaponry and things sometimes that are interesting. Even the modular nuclear power that's used on your subs and the aircraft carrier seems to be the future to solve that energy, I think. But maybe we can get you back to talk about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, nuclear is a must to do the bridge to renewable if we're ever going to get there.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
All right, John. Well, thank you very much.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.